ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, my name is Natasha Mitchell and welcome to Big Ideas. This is ABC Radio National's live event show. And today you're joining a former Australian Prime Minister, a former Canadian Deputy Prime Minister, and an audience in America at Harvard to talk leadership, democracy, the shifting tides of global politics, and how to be a good friend.
I think it is not only the right thing, I think it is the duty of other foreign leaders, particularly those that lead countries that are friends of the United States, to tell Trump the truth and actually say, look him in the eye and say, listen, you're wrong. You're going the wrong way. This is, you know, what you're proposing here is nuts, or, you know, you've got to take a different approach.
Yes, they always get refreshingly candid once they leave politics, don't they? And today's conversation comes from the prestigious Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts, with Australia's former and 29th Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, a businessman, lawyer, Republican, Liberal, now an outspoken critic of his former party and, as it happens, also president of the International Hydropower Association. He is speaking with Chrystia Freeland, former Canadian Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister in the Progressive Government of Justin Trudeau. She is also a former journalist and newspaper editor, and her books include Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else, and Sale of the Century, Russia's Wild Ride from Communism to Capitalism. She now serves as an economic advisor to the President of Ukraine. And you can share your thoughts as you're listening. The ABC Radio National text line 0418 226 576. 0418 226 576. Let's head to Harvard.
Thank you very much for that very kind and warm welcome. Thanks everyone for being here. And most of all, thank you, Malcolm, for being here. I was really, really excited when Malcolm accepted my invitation to come spend a day with us here at Harvard. You've heard a lot of the great things about him, and I just want to add a few more things so you like see the full Malcolm. Before going into politics, he had a really stellar career as a barrister. He took on MI6 and Margaret Thatcher, and he won the famous Spycatcher case. I think you were 31 years old at the time?
Yep, 31, 32, yeah.
So you can ask him about that if you want. Maybe we'll have a chance. Malcolm also is a type of small-c conservative, center-right leader. His party is actually the Liberal Party, as is mine, that can seem like a vanishing breed in this country. You've already heard about what the strong environmental policies that he put in place. And he actually, I think your first job as minister was as environment minister.
That's true.
And he continues today to be a big investor in renewables. He's also the prime minister who legalized same-sex marriage in Australia. And then the final thing I want to say about him is something quite personal. He's a really devoted family man and has a family that's devoted to him. Rare in politics to manage that. And then finally, a very personal thing. I got to know Malcolm at like the kind of summits that one goes to. And usually, if you're not the leader, you're just accompanying the leader, you are treated like a non-human by the very important leaders. Not that they're like mean to you, but it's like you're invisible. And something that I noticed right from the beginning is Malcolm actually treated me and all the other fellow invisible ministers like we were real people. And he talked to us and he wanted to know what our opinion was. I see that as a real high mark of character. So, Malcolm, your first encounter with President Trump in the first Trump administration was rather exciting. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, we had entered into an agreement with the Obama administration to assist each other with the resettlement of refugees. And that, when I say reached an agreement, it was a written agreement. It wasn't just sort of a political handshake or anything like that. And initially, we expected the Trump administration to honour it, even though we knew it was an agreement that Trump wouldn't have entered into. And then just before a call I was due to have with Trump, shortly after he was inaugurated, Pence rang my deputy and their national security advisor rang mine and said, no, the deal's off, the president's not going to honour it, the prime minister shouldn't bring it up. So naturally I had to, and, well, it was important to maintain it. And so we had a very tough conversation in which he was very, very angry. He was quite philosophical at times. He said to me once, he said, you're a businessman, you must have reneged on deals in the past. And I said, no, actually I don't. I believe you should, you know, word is your bond, et cetera. And so it was a very tough call, very angry call. He said it was the worst call of the day. But it began with no, but ended up with yes. And the important thing was that, you know, I mean, I stood my ground, I argued the case, and, you know, with great ill will and anger and, you know, and so forth, which he later made public deliberately, he honoured the deal. And the takeaway in a nutshell is that after that I had a good, very good working relationship with him, but I think it was because it had kicked off fortuitously with a row in which I had stood up to him and stood my ground. And I think that is, with personalities like Trump, that's the only way you should deal with them.
So, you know, in calls like that, it's not like you're by yourself on your phone and the president is by himself on his phone. You know, there are other people in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
As the president of the United States starts yelling at you.
And hopefully it's only the United States and Australia that's listening in, but I suspect.
Probably others.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did your team think as the president is getting madder and madder?
Yeah. Well, I was just, you know, one of my staff was on the other side of the desk. And I just, in the course of this call, I looked up and, he was literally as white as a sheet. And I'm not, a very white sheet. And, it was horrible. And I mean, someone in the White House, we assume it was Bannon, because they wanted Trump's supporters to know that he had done this reluctantly, or, you know, he didn't want anyone to think that he was an enthusiastic complier with this agreement from the Obama era. But so there was a redacted transcript of it was leaked out to the Washington Post. So it's, you know, it's on the public record. It's quite, the bits that were cut out were actually the best bits. But
do you want to share one or two?
No. Well, it was just all furious stuff. You know, I mean, I used to do. I'm not going to do it today, but I'll tell you a funny story if I may. We have every year in Canberra, we have what's called the Midwinter Ball, which is the press gallery organises and is essentially a fundraiser. And the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition are meant to give a speech, and they're meant to be funny speeches, and it's all super off the record, totally off the record. And I can't remember if it was that year or the later year, I gave a speech in which I didn't pretend to be Donald Trump, but the speech did get a bit Trumpy, I have to say. I do quite like a bit of amateur comedy. And anyway, went down a treat. Everyone thought it was fantastic. But unfortunately, somebody recorded it on their iPhone in breach of all the rules and put it up on the internet. And so the next time, about a month later, I bump into Trump literally. Well, I see him at the Hamburg G20, so I think it must have been 2017. And Trump says to me, he says, "So, Malcolm, I hear you've been having a little bit of fun at my expense." And I said, "Well, just very affectionately, Donald." And to give him credit, he said, yeah, they say you're better than Alec Baldwin. So I thought that was good. But again, you can imagine, you know, I had a couple of my staff with me. You can imagine when they said that, they were thinking, oh, no, you know, it's all coming to an end. So anyway, he doesn't seem to have his good humoured now.
So you had this quite explosive phone call.
Yeah, sure.
And then you had a meeting in the White House. And then how did that go?
Like, well, the next meeting I had was actually on the Intrepid in New York, and that was the sort of kiss and make up meeting, but it went really well. And he was, you know, the refugee issue and the agreement, and, you know, which everyone had been so exercised about. By that stage, he was joking about it. And it literally, I mean, we had a scene. That was joking about it then, but the funniest thing, experience I had with Trump was actually in a skiff. Does everyone know what a skiff is? You know, it's like a steel container. What does it stand for? Secure Communications Information Facility or something like that. But anyway, we're at Munich and I was trying to get Trump to agree that there would be no tariffs on Australian steel, right? That was really important to me. And he did. He gave us an exemption, by the way, which Navarro and
Lighthizer. I got one too for Canada.
Yeah, you did. Lighthizer and Navarro were really angry about it, you know. And so I said, we just want to have a chat. And he said, yeah, okay. And then he said, I want to show you my skiff. I did not at that stage know what a skiff was. I thought, good grief, has he bought a sailing boat to Hamburg? I thought anything's possible, you know. And I got there and it's literally like a steel box. And so he said, oh, you've got to come in. It's so cool. You know, the Chinese and the Russians can't hear what we're saying. But then everybody piled in. Emmanuel Macron, this is the first time Emmanuel met Trump. Theresa May was there. There were various, you know, lots of other people. Wilbur Ross was there. There was everyone with these people jamming into this steel box. And so we're sitting there and Trump's in the corner there, I'm like here, and Emmanuel Macron, you know, is sitting there, sitting on a table. And Emmanuel had some obscure thing he wanted Trump to do about the wording of a communique, which, you know, I mean. And I was saying, look, Emmanuel, seriously, nobody reads these things, it doesn't matter. So why do we care?
People here are the writers of communiques.
I know. But anyway. But then Trump said to him, so you've got to imagine this scene. Emmanuel Macron is a really good friend of mine, by the way, and I'm sure you like him too. I think he's one of the best leaders we have in the world today. But Emmanuel is like he's 38 or 9 at that stage. He is an absolute product of the elite French educational system. He's an anarchist, you know, from the top, you know, schools in France. You know, France is a big country in many ways, but in other ways a very small elite. And so he has never dealt with a guy like Donald Trump before in his life, you know. He's had as much experience with Martians as he's had with people like Donald Trump. And so Trump kicks off by says, Emmanuel, do you know Malcolm has 2,000 of the worst terrorists in the world, the worst, locked up on a desert island? And do you know that fool Obama, worst president ever, agreed to take them? And now he wants me to take them. I think you should take them, Emmanuel. Why don't you take them? And Macron is sitting there. He cannot believe it. But what is this going on? And I said, look, they're very nice people, Donald. They're fine. You'll get on well. They're yours. Anyway, and it sort of went on in this vein. And so, you know, I'd have to say, the relationship was good, and he was making, so it all became a bit of a joke. But the point, the bottom line was, you know, he's a fiercely competitive guy. His technique is to bully, and intimidate, you know. And I mean, look, he wrote, or either he wrote or someone wrote for him, a book that actually says that. So, you know, this is the interesting thing about Trump. Yes, does he make stuff up and tell untruths? Yes, of course he does. But he's, at times, he can be plainly, incredibly honest, like he doesn't make any bones about it. Does he believe, you know, people have said, oh, the Americans don't really believe in international law, they're just pretending they do. Trump doesn't make any bones about it. He says, no, we don't. In fact, in the official documents, National Defence Strategy describes the international rules-based order as a cloud castle abstraction, you know, which is a sort of, you know, posh way of saying bullshit, you know, so it's incredible. Right? So he says the quiet bits out loud. But I think we ended up having a good relationship, but he's a type of guy that if you don't stand up to him, you get run over. So that's the bottom line.
So I personally 100%, even 1,000% agree with that conclusion. What are the lessons there?
Donald Trump would say, you agree with me more than anybody has ever agreed with anybody in all of history.
Yes, correct. Yeah. On that point, yeah. Given that conclusion, yeah. What's the advice in the first instance for other world leaders who are dealing with Donald Trump today?
Oh, well, they he can't sack them, right? So that's the first thing. And I wrote an essay in Foreign Affairs last year in June, which said more about this, among other things, but making exactly this point. I think it is not only the right thing, I think it is the duty of other foreign leaders, particularly those that lead countries that are friends of the United States, to tell Trump the truth and actually say, look him in the eye and say, listen, you're wrong. You're going the wrong way. This is, you know, what you're proposing here is nuts, or, you know, you've got to take a different approach. And, you know, just nodding and sucking up is, I mean, it's disloyal because you're letting your own country down, but you're not acting like a good friend. I mean, it's like, you know, if you have a friend who's had too much to drink, I mean, do you give him the keys to the car? No, you hide the keys, you know, and call him a cab. And I think that the friends of the United States, the leaders who are the ones that talk to Trump, they really owe it to their country and to the friendship they have with America to be fearless in dealing with him.
So this hardly seems to be a truth universally acknowledged.
No.
And there is a different view, which is you have to kind of humor Trump.
Yeah.
Do you think that's working?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's absolutely not working. And I mean, the Europeans, you know, I tend to the European Union and Ursula von der Leyen as, you know, exhibit A in that. I mean, look at the way they rolled over to Trump on the trade stuff last year. Look at that excruciating meeting at Turnberry in Scotland. And what did they end up with? You know, abuse, humiliation, threats to seize Greenland. I mean, you cannot take a backward step. It can be really painful. But you can do all the courtesies in public, of course, you know. I mean, everyone does that. I'm not suggesting you go around punching people, let alone the President of the United States, in the nose. But I just think you've got to tell the truth. You've got to tell the truth and be plain, be blunt, you know. Polite, but blunt.
I think that's called Australian diplomacy.
Yeah,
diplomacy Australian style.
Probably. Well, it's certainly the way I've always operated.
Australian-style diplomacy, or Turnbull-style diplomacy. Yes, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull joins us today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas from the stage of the Harvard Kennedy School at Harvard University in the United States. It's great to have you with us. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Malcolm is speaking with former Canadian Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland.
What about NATO? Because there has been an argument there from the Europeans, you know, around how, well, we can't afford to be Australian blunt. We depend on the United States too much.
Well, yeah, but by the way, I'm not sure other Australian prime ministers would be as blunt as I have been and was. And I was pretty blunt with Obama too, by the way, on some other things. But that's just the way I am, right? I'm not good at being a sucker-upper. Look, NATO, you're right. The problem is that Ukraine is a hostage. That is the real problem. And you know this, Chrystia, better than anyone here, I guess. I mean, the anxiety is that Trump will withdraw support for Ukraine. I mean, he's qualified it and modified it. His sympathies are pretty clearly on the Russian side. I mean, he hasn't really looked. The humiliation of Zelensky in the Oval Office was one of the most horrible, you know, public spectacles any of us have ever witnessed, I would think. But, you know, Zelensky, you know, embodied the courage of the Ukrainian people, the way he stood up to that. But, yeah, I think that the Europeans have got to get their act together and defend themselves. I mean, in that sense, Trump is right. I mean, it is crazy, as Donald Tusk said, you know, why do 500 million Europeans need 350 million Americans to defend them against 140 million Russians? I mean, Russia has the GDP of Italy. So that the Europeans just, you know, they have to do that. And I think that's the essentially the Europeans have become infantilized. Now, here's an interesting thing about Europe. In the 60s, Presidents Kennedy, after which this centre is named, it's not yet the Trump Kennedy
forum. But don't give people bad ideas.
Yeah, no, but I'm glad that John F. Kennedy is still alone in his commemoration there. But Kennedy and Johnson were irritated by Charles de Gaulle's insistence that France remain utterly sovereign in terms of its military capabilities, you know, and de Gaulle pulled France out of the integrated military command of NATO, insisted that its nuclear deterrent be thoroughly sovereign, which is not the case with the UK's. And so he was a pain for the Americans. Interestingly, Vance, talking to Politico, I think was it last year it might have been, said de Gaulle was right. And he said that it is not in America's interest for the Europeans to be permanent vassals of the United States. And I'm not sure whether he definitely said that, but I think the point he was trying to make also was the Europeans had allowed themselves to be infantilized by the United States. And that was, I think there are good points there. I mean, I often compare the UK and Britain in terms of their defense, attitude to defense. And there is no doubt in my mind, and history's demonstrated this, that France was right, de Gaulle was right. I mean, if you look at the shocking state Britain's defences are in, particularly their navy, and compare that to France, it's a very sad contrast.
Okay, and Malcolm is, or one of his early positions, early in his political career, was being a Republican. So now we'll add to that that you're a Gaullist. I think those things go together. Yeah. Republican as in anti-monarchy. Republican.
Well, yeah, I've got I've got nothing against, you know, the British monarchy in Britain, right? And I have, and I wouldn't presume to say what Canada should do or New Zealand should do or, you know, the British Virgin Islands should do or whatever. But I always felt, and you know, the Republican movement in Australia has argued that we, Australians, head of state should be an Australian citizen, chosen by Australians. We have our constitution is incredibly hard to change. I mean, and compulsory voting doesn't help, by the way. It's one of our great prides, compulsory voting.
We're going to get to that,
but it doesn't help with referendums. And you know, we had a referendum about it in 99 and lost, sadly, but hopefully we'll have another crack at it at some point. But, yeah.
So I want to move Malcolm from Europe to the Asia Pacific.
Yes.
And we've talked a lot about the United States and how you handled the first Trump administration. Yeah. You also had a lot of very close dealings with China.
Mm-hmm.
How should the friends, the Western alliance, how should we be thinking about China and how should we be handling China now?
Well, I mean, I don't think we can't change China. Okay, I mean when we say handling China, what we really mean is how do we handle ourselves in dealing with China? Again, I think that's the same answer. Really, you just got to be strong. I mean, Sometimes the Chinese press would take offence at this, but I would often quote what Mao said, when in 1949, when he stood on top of Tiananmen. I won't try my terrible Mandarin, but and he said the Chinese people have stood up, right? And what he was saying was he was asserting Chinese sovereignty, and we must assert our own sovereignty. And we demand that that be respected as we respect China's. But, clearly, we have to manage risk. But I don't think we should, we shouldn't assume that there is a great, Manichaean conflict coming with China. I don't see why that's in China's interest to engage in a war with any of us, frankly. But I think you've got to hedge against that contingency. Look, I've had a long connection. I mean, I just to give you a bit of background, man, I'm not a Chinese speaker. I'm not like Kevin Rudd, is also Australian Prime Minister's Chinese is pretty much perfect, or as perfect as a non-Chinese person's Chinese could ever be. But I did do quite a bit of business in China in the early 90s. In fact, I set up among other things, a zinc mine, which was the first foreign mining project in China. It's a big zinc, now very big zinc mine, public listed company, in fact, no, just north of Zhangjiakou, if you know where that is, in the northern part of Hebei province, which is just north of Beijing. Hebei province is a province in the north, for those who are not familiar with it, and Beijing sort of sits in the centre of it. And, so I had a lot to do with, Chinese officials, local, provincial, central government in all of that sort of Dongbei region in the northeast of China, because I looked at a lot of projects. And so, I got on very well, and I felt you should just be plain, blunt person, play straight shooter. People used to say, faces at the compliment, would they say, you're just like someone from Liaoning, if you're in Liaoning. I said, what does that mean? Oh, you're very straightforward. That's good. And go to Shandong, they'd say, just like someone from Shandong. So, that's good.
So, Malcolm, in February, Canadians were asked in an opinion poll, which country poses the greatest threat to you?
Yeah.
55% said the United States.
Yeah, sure.
15% said China, and 15% said Russia.
Yeah.
Is China winning the global battle for hearts and minds right now?
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, it's and that poll tells you that. I mean, the number, you could argue that the 15%, the China number is too low or whatever, but the shocking thing is the United States. But why wouldn't it be? I mean, the American president has said, threatened to take over Canada. He's spoken about Canada in a dismissive, disrespectful manner and said it should be the 51st state. I mean, why wouldn't you regard that as a threat? I mean, Xi Jinping hasn't said that he thinks Canada should become a province of China. it may be that, he's very cunning and he's not telling anybody about it, but I think it's unlikely. I do. I think it's unlikely. There must be some fever dream in which someone imagines that to be the so. But I think the reality is that internationally, I'm not telling you anything you don't know that is not a penetrating glimpse of the obvious. The United States is seen internationally as much less reliable, if not unreliable. It's seen as being a force for disruption, not a force for order. And that is not, now that is, what I'm talking about is not a bug, that is a feature of the administration's approach. They are setting out that they are unreliable, keeping everyone, on their toes. I mean, Trump is one of those guys that, when you meet him, will shake hands and sort of give you a bit of a tug to try to pull you off balance. It's kind of, a lot of men do that. It's a sort of I've always felt it's a corny thing to do. It's not, I mean, he might have done that to me once, but I mean, it's just, it's a sort, it's not a, it's a harmless thing, But it's, you know, keeping people off balance. And that is, and that's part, again, that's part of his style. It is, again, it's in the book, you know, it's, and so, but if you do that, you will get the inevitable consequence. And that's what you've got. That's those numbers. So polling numbers like that would be similar everywhere, I think, among America's friends. It's a really disorienting time, you know, particularly for Canadians and Australians. I imagine a lot of Europeans too, who've always seen ourselves as being joined at the hip with America, sharing values, you know, just the ties are just so close. You know, we feel at home in America, Americans feel at home in Australia, you know, and now, and then you get all of this stuff. Yeah, it's a very disconcerting.
What about American business? You were a partner at Goldman Sachs. Yep. That's a world where you feel very much at home, that you were a part of.
Yeah.
What do you think about the positions American business leaders are taking?
Well, I'm really surprised with how sort of compliant and, you know, sycophantic so many of America's business leaders have been. Now, I would be surprised if they acted... I can't think of any other administration... You're all much better students of American political history than me. I cannot think of any other administration where business leaders have been quite so adulatory and obviously, you know, compliant of the president as they have of this one, right? And that is, and it's clearly because there's, you know, see, there's an advantage in that. But it's very, very dangerous. I mean, you know, we were talking earlier today about, you know, the way Edmund Burke in, you know, his reflections on the revolution in France was, you know, justifying the big landed estates of his, you know, Whig, you know, benefactors, was saying, talking about how they balanced the power of the state, you know, or the crown, really. And, you know, this has always been one of the arguments about, you know, a democracy, capitalist system, because, you know, there are big, you know, power is distributed. And it's not just distributed between the branches of government and so forth and between, you know, state, federal. It's also, you know, with powerful forces outside of government. But when everyone is just piling in and being recruited behind one political leader, it seems to me to be, and again, I'm not a student of American history in the way that so many of you are. It seems to me to be incredibly un-American. I've never seen anything like it. Certainly it's inconceivable that you'd see that in Australia. You know, I mean, the business leaders in Australia will be polite to the Prime Minister and, you know, they don't want to go and pick fights unnecessarily, but they're certainly not going to line up in the sort of conga line of adulation that you see at the moment.
And President Trump's recent visit to China, flanked by 12 American billionaires, could be a case in point. On ABC Radio National, this is Big Ideas with former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, offering his appraisal of the world as it is right now. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and asking the questions on stage at the Harvard Kennedy School in the US is former Canadian Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. Next up, the A word.
What does that mean, you think? What does all of that mean, you think, of AUKUS?
Well, AUKUS, does everyone know what AUKUS is? Okay, I better just explain it quickly. So AUKUS is a partnership between Australia, the UK and the United States, and it was instigated by Australia, by Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister who succeeded me, very much at the very strong encouragement by the British, and their goal was to terminate a contract we had with France to build a fleet of submarines with France and instead do a deal with Britain, right? Now, Britain's shipbuilding industry is in absolute disarray. Their submarine industrial base is in absolute disarray. I can see why they wanted the Australian money, but there's no way this was a smart idea for Australia. But, of course, the problem was that they needed the Americans to go along with it, and for whatever reason, Biden went along with it. Now, the problem was that because of the time delays and so forth, there was no way any British-Australian submarine could be available in a way that would ensure that we did not have a long period of time, maybe as much as two decades, without any submarines at all. You know, this so-called capability gap. And the solution for that was that the Americans would agree to sell us a number of Virginia-class submarines, second-hand Virginia-class submarines, which is America's, you know, current attack submarine, what's called an SSN, as opposed to the SSBNs, which are the, you know, the big, the boomers that have the nuclear deterrent. Now, the problem is that the US is not building enough submarines for its own Navy. So they really need to be building at least, completing at least two Virginias a year to meet their own needs, and to meet Australia's needs as well, they'd have to be about 2.3. The current rate of production is and has been for some years, despite a lot of money being spent, between 1.1 and 1.2 a year. Congress was aware of this and so put in the legislation language which said that no submarine could be sold to Australia unless the President certified a whole bunch of things, the most relevant one being that the sale would not degrade the underwater capabilities of the US Navy, which, given that they're short of these submarines and they are by far the most important units in any Navy nowadays because they're the most survivable. The bottom line is that, you know, when 2031, when that decision has to be taken, it is difficult to see how any President, even if they were the greatest, even if they had a mantelpiece covered in koalas, difficult to see how they could possibly responsibly agree with it, right? And so the problem is it is a terribly bad deal. And we're, for our part, you know, we're providing a naval dockyard and a submarine base for the Americans in Perth and at enormous expense. And, yeah, it's just a really bad deal. And, I mean, people, you know... There's a kind of an element in the right-wing media in Australia, particularly Murdoch's media. He has a newspaper called The Australian, which should actually be called The American. and the sort of anybody that questions aspects of the alliance with the United States is, you know, sort of denounced as being, you know, unpatriotic. Well, I happen to think an Australian patriot puts Australia first. That's, you know, call me simplistic and old-fashioned. So that is a very bad deal. In fact, people were saying, you know, there's an anxiety in Australia about do the Americans love us? Fear of abandonment, as Alan Gingell described it once, which is a bit like the British anxiety about the special relationship. You know, the Brits always talk about the special relationship. It reminds me of the anxious boyfriend, you know, who says to his girlfriend, "Do you love me? Do you really love me? No? I saw you yesterday. You were on, you know, on the other side of the street, but you didn't smile at me. Does that mean you don't love me anymore?" You know, and it's kind of sad. And I think the message for all of us, and certainly my view in office was, and remains the same, is that we simply have to be more self-reliant. We really do. Now, we don't have the ability to do in our part of the world what the Europeans can do. It means if the European members of NATO get their act together, can they defend themselves? Absolutely. No question at all. But they've got to get over their internecine hang-ups and, you know, be prepared to have common... They've got to basically do with defence platforms what they did with Airbus, essentially, and, you know, what they've done with the Eurofighter and a few other things. But for us, it's a different equation, but, you know, Australia doesn't really fear imminent invasion in the way Europe could or can from Russia. But I think we need to be focused on defending ourselves and have the ability to be enough of it, provide enough of a deterrent, and do so not assuming that the Americans will save us. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew summed this up very well in the 60s when he talked about a Chinese proverb. I mean, there's a Chinese proverb for everything. I suspect most of them are made up, by the way, but Lee Kuan Yew was Chinese, so if you're Chinese...
He was allowed to.
You can make up Chinese proverbs. But it's a great, great one, which was big fish eat the little fish eat the shrimps. And he said, you know, we're a shrimp, but so we have got to make ourselves a poisonous shrimp so that no one is going to want to eat us because that'll kill them. And we've also got to make friends with other little fish and, you know, and make sure that we get some, you know, friends around us. And it was, when I gave a speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue some years ago, I used that line. And it's that's essentially what middle powers or smaller powers, non-superpowers have got to do.
Okay. I'm going to offer one editorial comment and then we'll throw it open to questions. And the editorial comment on Europe is, you pointed out, Malcolm, that Russia has the GDP of Italy, so surely Europe can defend itself. I would point out Ukraine has the GDP of Nebraska, and they have been more than defending themselves for 4 years. Mm. All the more reason Europe should feel, I mean, are they worse than the Ukrainians, really?
No, yeah. Well, let me make add a footnote to that excellent point. There's a think tank in Australia called ASPI, Australian Strategic Policy Institute, I think it is, something like that. And they have been doing work on tracking technology and who's ahead in technology and so forth. And in terms of defence platforms, you can forecast what a country is going to be able to deploy when you look at the type of research that their scientists are doing, the fundamental research that's being published. And they've been making the point for some time about Iran, and there's a recent paper up you could find on their website, which points out that in a number of key areas, not many, but a number of key areas, Iran has been in the top 10 in the world. Now, you wouldn't have thought Iran would be in the, leaders in research. They don't have, obviously, the breadth of China or the United States, but they, with their very limited budget, they targeted those areas that they thought were fundamental to their strategic situation. And, they've obviously been demonstrating that.
Okay, we're going to throw it open to questions. So please go to the mics, anyone who wants to ask a question.
Okay.
And I'm just going to offer one friendly thought to Malcolm.
Yeah.
So in Canada, in question period, ministers have 35 seconds to answer.
Yeah.
And after 35 seconds, you're cut off.
Right, okay. Good.
So is it 35 seconds in Australia?
That's 3 minutes, but I'll do 30.
See? Pretend you're Canadian.
I'll pretend I'm Canadian.
Okay, please.
So, hi, Malcolm. My name's Jaden. I'm actually an Australian. I'm a visiting PhD student here in Earth and Planetary Sciences.
Yeah.
I'm actually a young Liberal, and I'm actually running for the Australian Student Liberal Federation presidency this year. But I'm not sort of... I've currently got the issue inside the Liberal Party is that everyone's crazy. As you can see, I'm wearing an Indigenous rights shirt. I've got blue nail polish on. Mm. I consider myself a very progressive Liberal, but I detest the Labor Party, I detest the Teals, and I detest the Greens. So I consider myself a hardcore centrist Liberal. Do you have any advice for someone like me trying to get involved in the Liberal Party and this climate and this environment?
Well, persevere, get involved and change it. That's, history's made by those who turn up. And I would strongly discourage you from detesting anybody. I think there's good in all your political rivals or almost all of them. So, but just get involved. History's made by those who turn up.
Is the centre right, though, the kind of people that Jaden is describing, the kind of politician you have been? Is that a species in danger of extinction in Australia and maybe in the United States?
Yeah, well, I've always preferred clear nail polish, as you can see. I'm not a nail polish kind of person, but the reality is politically, the people that are closest to that centre, right, liberal, smaller liberal view of the world in politics now are, in fact, the Teals, which most people don't know. Australians know what we're talking about. But these are centrist independents who've, because of our excellent voting system, have been able to win what had been hitherto safely conservative seats.
Please.
Thanks for being here, Malcolm. I'm Manning. I'm an MPP2 at the Kennedy School. We spent the beginning of this talk discussing volatile leaders and how to engage with them. Australia is seeing the rise of several volatile leaders in One Nation, the far-right party that's led by Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce, who you know well. I'm interested in what advice you would give to leaders like Angus Taylor, the current leader of the Liberal Party, in terms of countering the growth of far-right parties, given all of the challenges that have driven their rise.
Yeah, well, Angus has got to stop running off to the right, trying to compete with One Nation. I mean, if you are in a centre-right party and you are being challenged by right-wing populists, the worst thing you can do is go off and try to compete with them on their ground, because you cannot outflank people that are completely reckless, right? You've got to tack back to the centre and focus on the economy, economic growth, productivity, jobs, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, the culture war stuff that the angertainment right-wing media is drawn the right wing of politics into is been completely catastrophic for them. I mean, centre-right parties are never going to win elections on education or health or social welfare, even if they've got better policies. Very hard. They win by focusing on economic management. And if you're not talking, you know, you've got to do it eloquently, if you're not talking about jobs and investment and getting a better deal for your family and making housing more affordable, if you're not talking about those fundamentals, you know, people have no use for you.
Malcolm, how viable is that approach in a media environment dominated by the Murdoch media?
Oh, I think you can outflank the Murdoch media. I think the problem with the Murdoch media is it was a problem for me because a lot of my base were living in that bubble. But their influence over the whole country is less and less. You know, they've sort of captured one side of politics and are slowly killing it. You know, I mean, killing it by people rushing down that. I mean, you know, friends of mine in the Labor Party, you know, ministers, a couple of them have said to me, you know, it's called Sky News in Australia, unrelated to the Sky News in the UK, but saying Sky News is just like Fox in Australia. Sky News is the best thing that's ever happened to the Labor Party because it pulled the Liberals off into that crazy land. And in a system like ours with compulsory voting and preferential voting, which brings politics to the centre, that is self-destructive.
Okay, please.
Hello. I also wanted to ask a question about Pauline Hanson and the fact that Trumpism seems to be becoming more rooted in countries around the world and not just in the United States.
Well, it's certainly rooted in Hungary.
I'm curious to ask you, though, is
rooted
the solution...
means something different in Australia than what it does here. So.
Is the solution to that to... It seems like a lot of voters are choosing people like Pauline Hanson not because they agree with her on all the issues, but because they're so dissatisfied with how out of touch they perceive the governing parties to be. I'm curious, like the Tories in the UK, is your party experiencing this kind of perception of total elitism that is causing people to drift towards Pauline Hanson? And do you think that the solution to Pauline Hanson is more about rhetoric or more about image of the party as a whole?
No, I think the... Look, I mean, Hanson is not in the, you know, Donald Trump's league, or she's been around for a very long time. It'll bore everyone that's not an Australian witless to try to explain it. But I think a lot of the votes that you're seeing for her, and we've seen it before actually in Queensland, it is a very much, you know, you can all go to hell, I hate you all. What's that line from Network? I'm Peter Finch's line, I'm mad as hell and I'm not taking it anymore. It's that kind of reaction, I think, very much so. In terms of dealing with, you know, more systematic, more effective populists, the answer is you've got to deliver. I mean, I have a series of podcasts, I haven't done any new ones for about a year, but called Defending Democracy, which talks about all of these issues. And in one of them was a discussion with Theresa May, former PM of the UK, is an old university friend of mine, in fact. And I asked Theresa this very question that you just asked me. And she said, well, you have to deliver. You know, liberal democracy has to deliver. You know, you've got to be able to deliver affordable housing, you know, sense that people can get ahead, and, you know, that they're not going to be doing worse than their parents. And you've got to give, you've got to, and if you're not delivering on that, then people will be tempted to look to the charismatic person who says, I alone can fix it, you know? And they'll say, well, what have I got to lose? Well, as it happens quite a lot, but they don't know that until it's too late often.
Okay, we're going to have one last question.
Awesome. Thank you so much again for speaking. This will probably come off as a very America-centric question, but I'll ask it anyways. So I guess given that this is an atypical...
Well, we are in the center of America, isn't that? Isn't Harvard the center of America?
I guess maybe in the last 2 years, not so much, but Yeah, I mean, especially given that this is such an atypical time in American politics, I was curious, like, from the perspective of the rest of the world, when it comes to, like, crafting foreign policy, is there value in investing serious effort in, like, building foreign policy where the U.S., for a longer period of time beyond just this next four-year term, is going to play a lot less reliable of a role of its, like, traditional place in foreign policy? Or do you think it's best viewed as kind of an anomalous period of time where things will sort of revert back to normal?
Excellent question.
That's really the, in a way, that's the key question. Well, let me put it this way. Let's say Trump, you know, Trump's term comes to an end. Let's say the next president is a Democrat, okay? And that president, whoever it is, stands up and says, America is back. You know, we're back, your good old reliable friend. No one is going to be convinced, right? Everyone is going to say, oh, yeah, prove it. You know, so it's going to take a while to rebuild that trust. I mean, Trump won was seen as an anomaly because, you know, he kind of fluked the Republican nomination. He didn't expect to win that, then didn't expect to win the election. He won that, and then he lost. Then you had the January 6th debacle, and people thought, oh, well, that's the end of that. Now he's back and he won, you know, big majority, legitimately. You know, it's got much more control over his administration, his party and so forth. And the zeitgeist seems to have changed. So I think it'll take a while, but I think the amount of soft power that has been torched in recent years is just tragic. And, you know, those of us who are friends of the United States, I think Canada and Australia would rank themselves as being, very good friends, best friends, it's heartbreaking. So, but I think it will take time, and I hope that, you know, many of you are involved in that effort to do that. But it's, you know, there's going to have to be an honest reckoning of the, you know, the damage that has been done. I mean, you know, you look at the business with Iran right at the moment. I mean, the unforeseen blocking of the Strait of Hormuz. Apparently, this was unforeseen. Really, hard to believe. You know, Iranians have been threatening to block it for a very long time, never done so, and now they've worked out they can do it. Trump reminds Americans that America is not going to be unduly inconvenienced by that. Well, let me tell you, in my part of the world, we are massively inconvenienced by it. And the countries that will be most inconvenienced by it are the poorer countries, because rich countries like Australia can afford to pay more for oil and diesel and, you know, everything else to make sure that we have the supplies. But, you know, if you're in the Philippines or in, you know, any other part of Southeast Asia or India or you're in Africa, you are in a world of trouble. So, you know, you're not saying to yourself, oh, no, I'm just going to have to put up with this. This hardship is all worth it because, you know, those Iranians needed to have some bombs dropped on them. No, you're just completely baffled why this has all happened to you. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's been a... There's a lot of trust that's going to have to be rebuilt, but it will take time. So good luck. When you're Secretary of State, I'm sure you'll have it sorted out.
Good luck indeed. That was former Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Speaking with the host, Chrystia Freeland, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. She is currently a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, which hosted this event. Big thanks to the team and to the savvy audience of Future Leaders in Making for their questions. You can let us know your thoughts. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. bigideas@abc.net.au. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for your company. Catch you next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.